The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. And with those words from Gramsci, I welcome you once again to the Time of Monsters podcast. Over the last few weeks, we've touched on the sort of ongoing Clarence Thomas scandal a few times, and the scandal continues to get worse. I'm going to be talking about that in a second with Alexander Salmon, who's a political writer for Slate. But I think the one thing I'd want to sort of start off by mentioning is some of Thomas's kind of thinking in all this, which is Thomas. I mean, like, he has said, well, you know, like, this was his relationship with Harlan Crowe, the wealthy benefactor, you know, who really, I think, can almost be fairly described as his sugar daddy, is, you know, like, just one of friends, and therefore private and nobody's business. But I think there's, like, an ideological dimension I want to open up with, which is, like, Thomas's very strong belief in a very familiar type of American upward mobility, you know, where you pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you rise. And I think that one aspect of this, you know, ideology that doesn't get enough attention is the relationship between the patron and the hardworking, upwardly mobile poor. This is, you know, one sees this in the sort of classic 19th century novels of Horatio Alger's, you know, like, there's the raggedy poor orphan who works hard, and then at some point he's noticed by a rich man who then takes him under his wings and nurtures him, and eventually, you know, he kind of marries the rich man's daughter. This is the I really think that this sort of story, I mean, this is something deep in Thomas's way of thinking, that he comes from a very poor family, but one that was able to make something of itself, even in, you know, the horrors of the Jim Crow South. And so this is something I think that is gets at maybe close to the heart of his thinking. But and coupled with that is a sense that he's not getting what he's deserved. There's an interesting article in 2001 in the New York Post where he gave a kind of heartfelt speech thanking someone who had helped him in some litigation. And in the New York Post article, Thomas says at one point about his job as a Supreme Court justice, "The job is not worth doing for what they pay." And I think that, which is, I mean, to be fair, I think he might be right in the sense that, you know, anyone who's on the Supreme Court could be making much more money doing something else. But I think usually in a sort of a self-governing republic, it's understood, you know, there's a certain amount of sacrifice that's made for public service. I mean, I think in some ways, Thomas sort of feels like, well, he's kind of getting what he deserves. But that's just, I just want to open with that kind of speculation. But Alex, do you want to, like, maybe update listeners as to what we've just learned in the last few days?
Yeah, the sort of cascade of scandals is amazing. It's, like, hard to even keep up with. And by the time this runs, or maybe new details, but we know, obviously, that that he, you know, that he's been taking, that Clarence Thomas has been taking private jet flights that were paid for by Harlan Crowe. We know that Harlan Crowe purchased his mother's house and lets her live there rent free. We know now that Thomas's adoptive son was enrolled in a very expensive private school, and Harlan Crowe generously paid the tuition. None of this was disclosed, despite the fact that in this most recent scandal regarding the tuition, Thomas did disclose a different gift of $1,500 for tuition. So he does know at some level that that's the sort of thing that would be required to be disclosed. But the $6,200 a month he was getting from Crowe for this particular enrollment didn't make the disclosure list. So I think those are the big ones. But I think there's also been details that have come out about how clearly Harlan Crowe's interests were represented on this court, his having benefited from the Supreme Court overturning the eviction moratorium, which Crowe was, you know, personally against, and his business would have been hurt by the extension of. The details are astonishing, and even saying them out loud now, it's like hard to believe.
No, they are kind of hard to believe. And so we, I mean, what we learned even a few weeks ago was kind of listening. It seems like it's getting worse. And it seems like the good folks at the ProPublica, which is a nonprofit journalist outfit that's uncovered all this, they continue to do work. I believe they tweeted several times, you know, this is an ongoing story. So one could easily imagine more information coming out. And not just about Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, another justice, also had a kind of very troubling, you know, financial relationship where he had a co-owned a property that wasn't selling for a long time, and then suddenly he was elevated to the courts and it suddenly sold to you know, someone from a law firm that has often does business before the courts, as they say. So it seems like there's a lot going on in the courts that should be looked at. And and I think this gets at maybe the more towards the real meat of the scandal. It's not just like, you know, what these justices are doing, you know, requires investigation and perhaps punishment, but also the failure of the system to do so. And I want to start off with Sheldon Whitehouse, who's a Democratic senator, and as he's been generally like one of the more forceful voices on these issues. But he tweeted something which I thought was very telling. He's about the latest Thomas scandal. He said, "When does the stench get bad enough for the Supreme Court that the Supreme Court stops the cover up and ends the mischief? This is on the Chief Justice to solve." Plain and simple. Mom's rent, family tuition, vacations and gifts, and secret. Any other government employee would be fired. So, I mean, on one hand, a very strong statement. I think it's right that, like, anyone else in the federal government who was, like, secretly receiving the kind of gifts that Thomas was and didn't disclose them, you know, they would be in big trouble. But I want to, you know, to me, like, what stands out there is this is on the Chief Justice, you know, John Roberts, to solve plain and simple. Do we agree with that? Is this on simply on the Chief Justice to solve?
Right. I mean, it's such a ridiculous suggestion. I think you're right to point out, too, that what's so crazy about this scandal is that sort of the breadth of the gift receiving, the incredible array of gifts and donations and all this stuff that that Clarence Thomas has taken. But then you also have the very direct 1-2 sort of punch where you see Harlan Crow's own interest represented. And it's the same thing with the Neil Gorsuch case, where it's like, okay, this firm that is constantly in front of him buys this house. It's like their interest. It's not something where there's this sort of soft conspiratorial thing where you're like, oh, he's getting these gifts. And like, maybe they'll, you know, the interest will be in the back of his mind when something comes up down the line. It's like, no, they're it's very direct. It's like they get the thing and then they get the payoff right away. The idea that, I mean, the other thing we should add too, is that like Sam Alito is also in the pages of the Wall Street Journal having his own freak out. I mean, his is different in that it's not a sort of gift taking scandal, but it's also him saying stuff that is just totally improper for the court, for a Supreme Court justice to be saying about how he knows who leaked the Dobbs decision and how you know, like public opinion is there's a campaign against the court and everyone's against him and there's this conspiracy to undermine his personal authority and reputation and also the courts. I mean, the whole thing is totally out of control. The idea that John Roberts is right is going to do this, is B, could be even trusted to do this, is preposterous to rein all this in. It's like there are so many leaks in this ship at this point. And one of them is literally, obviously, the literal leak of the Dobbs decision is just one thing that kind of started this whole saga. But right, the idea that Roberts is like, first of all, that he is not implicated in the reality of the court as it currently stands. Of course he is. And like the fact that he did his great investigation to see who leaked the decision and couldn't come up with anything. It's like, of course that Roberts can't be trusted to do this. It's a ridiculous suggestion. And White House is a pretty good senator. It really does speak to a certain just like a fundamental block in the way you think about these, or the way Democrats are thinking about these things.
Well, yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I think that he I should say, like, you know, Sheldon Whitehouse, like, you know, like of all the Democrats senators, at least, who are you know, deal with these issues, he's actually been the most forceful. That's why I thought his statement was kind of stood out that he you know, this is the best that they got. And but
Right.
even beyond that, I mean, like, it's a weird sort of anomaly in the system, because normally in the Constitution, like, you know, you don't have each branch of the government self-regulating. In fact, the you know, the onus and the burden for when judges, most federal judges, misbehave, actually falls to the Congress, and especially the Senate. That you know, Congress has the House of Representatives has the duty and the right to impeach, and the Senate, with a, you know, two-thirds majority, has the ability to remove judges. It's very rarely done. I mean, that's a very high hurdle, very high hurdle to jump over. But it has happened in the past. You know, there have been cases, and there've also been cases of judges, even at the level of the Supreme Court, who, after, you know, a corruption case, were corruption allegations much less serious than what we're hearing now, were like made to resign. Famously, Abe Fortas in the 1960s. And so in all those cases, it's not like well, one would say, well, the judiciary has total self-control and it's up to the judges to police themselves. That's not actually what the Constitution says. That's not how the system works. And logically speaking, you know, even if it weren't clear in the Constitution, just like logically, like, where do we expect, like, you know, institutions to police themselves? Like, so you know, Congress has, and this, particularly the Senate part of the you know, has in theory the power to investigate and to set, like, rules for ethics, and to set punishments, the punishment, you know, could be much lighter than it deserves. I mean, impeachment is a kind of punishment that you could get with a majority in the House, but in any case, yeah, so what do we think about, like, you know, do you think the Democrats, especially, I think, Dick Durbin of Illinois, the senator who's sort of running the House Judiciary Committee, like, do you think that, like, any of the sort of steps I've outlined are things that Dick Durbin might end up doing, that the things that are in his power, like, what are the chances that he could push for that?
Yeah, I think that the question of what Durbin will do is really, really interesting. The statements he's made, we can run through them. Yeah, I think Durbin has had a very bad 2 months, I would say, just from the get-go. The one thing that really strikes me in what you're saying to you, which I think is so smart, is that, right, of course it's preposterous to say this one branch of government is going to be the most powerful, and also it's going to self-regulate. It makes no sense. And, like, when we talk about, like, I think when we talk about people like Durbin, sometimes people like Biden, and even maybe someone like White House, when we talk about these Democrats who don't want to do the enforcement that needs to be done, we often say, like, oh, they're institutionalists, they're sort of, like, institutionally conservative, whatever. But I would say that that's the opposite of being an institutionalist. Like, if you're an institutionalist, you should believe in the co-equal branches of government. You have to believe in the ability of Congress to enact oversight. Like, if you believe in the institution of American governance, you would say that actually you have to do the exact opposite. You have to be very aggressive about enforcing these standards and doing oversight and checking the power of these groups. And, like, to be like, oh, you know, whatever, like, what can we do about the Supreme Court? It's got to take care of itself. That's not an institutionalist mindset, to my mind. I think that's actually, it actually sort of bespeaks a disbelief in the way that this government structure is set up.
I mean, it's true. We need a different name. It is usually called institutionalism, but it's not that. It's a kind of status quo bias, or like rock the boatism, or, you know, it's like, inactivism, you know? Lovers of Russian literature, I often would say that the Democratic Party is the Oblomov of political institutions, like the hero of that great novel. They kind of like to stay in bed and not do anything. And again, Durbin has a statement which you tweeted out, which I think is, you know, similar to the White House statement, where he said, "I hope that the Chief Justice understands that something must be done. The reputation and credibility of the court is at stake." So again, the statement is, well, this is terrible. Something has to be done. John Roberts, will you please save us?
It's shocking. And the interesting thing is, this comes immediately after Durbin, when the last, in the last ProPublica story was published, obviously there was huge outcry. It was Durbin needs to get Clarence Thomas to the Senate to testify about this. Very straightforward, reasonable course of action. Durbin, instead of doing that, refuses to do that. He says, actually, I'm going to ask John Roberts to come instead. And so he puts out a kind request to John Roberts to come down and speak about this reputational crisis, basically about the court. And of course, Roberts says, no, I'm not going to do that. And so then what happens? Then nothing happens, of course. And then we wait another week. And then here again, we have another scandal. And what do we get out of Durbin? It's, well, John Roberts really needs to understand that this is not great. And like, he needs to talk to his guys and, they need to get this house in order. It's like, it's the sequence is so, it's just nonsense. It's like, of course, Durbin said the reason he didn't invite Clarence Thomas to testify was because he knew he wouldn't come. And like, that was supposed to be some tactical thing where he was like, I'm not going to ask Thomas because I know he's not going to say yes. I'm going to ask John Roberts instead. John Roberts just said no. What was the consequence of saying no? Nothing. And then now we get an even softer ask of Roberts, which is basically like a mean tweet being like, hey man, like you gotta look into this. Like this is not great.
Yeah, I think it's generous to say that it's even a mean tweet. It's more like a begging
Yeah.
tweet, and literally, I mean a lot of what Durbin is doing is rise to the level of like begging Roberts and begging the Republicans to like be better. Can you please fix this for us and not be so bad and so corrupt? It's a now and I mean on the issue of bringing Thomas before the Senate, in theory they could subpoena him. Now they can't right now because Dianne Feinstein is
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
On the House Judiciary, on the Senate Judiciary Committee, they need her vote, and she is, as everyone knows, incapacitated, and by some reports, may never be able to return to Washington D.C. And within that, you know, on the one hand, one could say, and in that context, Durbin made another statement where he basically said, you know, he's calling on Republicans to show, quote, kindness, end quote, by allowing the Democrats to replace Dianne Feinstein. And of course, the Republicans responded to this very pathetic plea with, I think, the sort of contempt that it deserves. And, you know, like they're not going to do it, obviously, because the Republicans are a serious political party that believes in working towards gaining power and, you know, imposing its worldview. I mean, like, you know, like one could say a lot of things about the Republicans, and one could, you know, even say that I'm happy to that their, you know, worldview is fundamentally, you know, evil and authoritarian, but they're actually like working towards, they're functioning as a political party should. So whereas Durbin, I mean, I think we have to rope in this whole issue with the Dianne Feinstein, because I think that, yeah, again shows, you know, like, you know, their unwillingness to like deal with that issue, which is like, you know, hurting them, like not only with subpoenaing Clarence Thomas, but with actually like, you know, advancing more federal judges. I mean, what does that say about how the Democrats are, you know, waging a political battle?
Totally right. It's just like this fundamental, the what you get with Durbin and with some Senate Democrats across the board is just this willingness to put enacting the agenda on the back burner. It's not even a primary concern. Republicans have no issue with this, right? They're like, whatever, they will pull whatever lever is available to them to enact the agenda. And with Democrats, you don't see that at all. And Durbin is a real exemplar of this. I mean, there are a couple of things that I think the strongest statement that we got from him about any of this was he said that all nine justices think they're above the rules. Well, again, trying to make this seem like it's a bipartisan issue, it's just not even factual. It's just not even, you know, there's just not even any evidence to back up that the three liberal justices have the same problems and the same contempt for the rules and for ethics and for disclosure. It's just not true. So that's one thing. And it does really, really boil down to Feinstein, because I mean, the sort of pitiful plea to like take pity on Feinstein and let her be replaced. Of course, it wasn't going to work. They did that, and then nothing, and then nothing, and then it failed, and then nothing. And so, and when I said, you know, that Durbin had a very bad 2 months, I mean this because he's getting it from all sides with the blue slips issue, which is this procedural ploy that Republicans are using to gum up the works even further on judicial nominees. Republicans, without getting too in the weeds on this stuff, like, you know, this is something, this is a standard Republicans did not hold themselves to when they had control of the Senate. It gives minority party ability to gum up the judicial nomination and confirmation process. Durbin is willingly allowing Republicans to do this. Democrats are falling just perilously behind in confirming these judges. And he still, it said 2 months ago that he was going to look into changing it or like take a hard look at what's happening. Of course he hasn't done anything. And so you have Republicans are blocking them on all angles. They can't get Democratic justices or judges confirmed because Feinstein's not there, because they won't help him out with replacing her. And then they can't get judges who are from Republican states because Republican senators are blocking those using blue slips. And, you know, all the while, you know, Durbin, one of the few things he's done is endorse Paul Vallis for mayor of Chicago. That didn't work out. You know, it's like this, when you look at the whole picture of his sort of political agenda and his willingness to act and what he cares about, the portrait is so dismaying. And it actually is really interesting and important for Democrats generally, because Durbin was in line to replace Harry Reid in 2015. Like, this could have been the whole experience for Democrats with their control of the Senate. And Chuck Schumer leapfrogged him and you know, ended up obviously being the top dog in the Senate for Democrats. But we could have been talking about this on every level. I mean, this is a theory of governance that exists and had a lot of cachet with Democrats. It's less popular now, but Durbin is an incredibly important role still. It's so frustrating. And I think it's important to realize like how much sway he might have had in this party, you know, if things had gone a little differently.
Yeah, no, it's true. Yeah. I mean, one can make a lot of, criticisms of Chuck Schumer, but he is at least more aware of the sort of, you know, polarized and partisan nature of politics, and less kind of beholden to that, you know, mythology of bipartisanship and, you know, Senate collegiality that seems to be, ruling Durbin's mind. I mean, it really is. He, like a lot of other, you know, leaders in the Democratic Party, are kind of like, you know, really living in the past. They're trying to recreate a past, acting as if, you know, like if we act in a, you know, collegial bipartisan matter, the Republicans will eventually reciprocate, and, you know, we'll go back to the 1970s. Or it's just I'm trying to sort of retroactively try to figure out what the thinking here is. Like, but it seems to me like that's the only thing that can kind of make sense, that they're kind of, you know, trying to model a way of governing that, you know, hasn't existed for like several decades now.
Right, absolutely. I mean, that's just the problem with having a political class that's so old, and a leadership class in particular that's so old. And this is actually a bigger problem for Democrats and Republicans, which have a slightly, you know, especially in the House, are much younger. Republicans have a much younger group that is ascendant and is now going to leadership roles. The notion of how Washington works was informed by a time when things were very different. And I think that's sort of the Durbin conundrum, is his understanding of how these parties interact, how the Republican Party pursues its agenda, how it, you know, trades off with Democrats, is just not the political reality that we live in. And it hasn't been that way for a long time, but that's how he understood it as a younger person. That's the framework that he has. And, you know, so his political philosophy, his theory, is just perilously outmoded. And you see a lot of that in Washington. I think it's why it's so frustrating dealing with some of these, with Democrats on some of these things, where it's like, what world are you living in? It just doesn't work like that, and it hasn't worked that for so long.
No, absolutely, yeah. So I one thing, a takeaway I want to really leave listeners with is that there's actual like things that could be done, you know, to counter the courts that are not being done. I mean, you know, they could move forward with Dianne Feinstein resigning and then, you know, being replaced, and that would help them get more judges on, and they could also, you know, move forward on getting rid of the blue chip, and that would allow them to also like particularly advance the judges that they want in red and purple states. They're not doing that now. They could, you know, if they have like another senator from California in there, move forward with subpoenaing Clarence Thomas. And they could also move forward, I think, on this whole issue of the legitimacy of the courts, and not say, well, this is a problem, but it's on, you know, John Roberts. And I want to actually circle back to that Alito interview, which is worth like reading. It's just like sort of frothing mad, and Alito's, you know, and this is actually something one's hearing more and more, not just from Alito but from sort of Federalist Society conservatives, that there's a plot to delegitimize the courts, and that there's a plot to and one would, you know, like as often with right-wing rhetoric, you know, like, if only that were so, if only there were actually, you know, but on the one hand, it's true, the courts are being delegitimized, but that's happening like simply because the public is seeing what the courts are doing. They're seeing decisions like Dobbs, decisions like the, you know, recent Texas judge that, you know, wanted to strike down access to abortion pills across the country, and they don't like this stuff. And then they're also seeing, I think, these corruption scandals. And so they're having the approval rating of the Supreme Court is, you know, by polling at a historic low. You know, we don't have polling for all of American history, but like, let's say the last 60, 70 years, we do have polling on, and it's never been as low. And it's gone through like a really rapid decline in the last 2 years. And this is, I think, what people like Alito are upset at. They can see that. They can see that, you know, their power is in the courts, but that increasingly a lot of the public doesn't think that what they're doing is legitimate. And what, again, one would say, if there was a political party that was serious about power and serious about advancing its agenda, they could look at this legitimacy crisis as an opportunity. They could actually do the things that the Alito is accusing them of, which is like, you know, like making an issue of this and like really running on this and saying like, yes, the courts are illegitimate. This is like, you know, and this is a big problem and we have to, you know, take radical steps to solve this. I mean, how do you see this like legitimacy issue playing out?
Yeah, it's incredible to me because a lot of these, what we're not calling institutionalist Democrats, these inactivists or whatever the term that of art that we're going to come up with here.
Let's call it like a Garfield conservative. Garfield Democrats. So they're like, okay, yeah, I can't stand the Mondays, you know, like when will Friday get here? Right. I just want to eat a lasagna. They're the sort of, you know, fat, lazy cat Democrats.
Yeah. Right. That group of politicians, we're seeing them, like their lament is like, oh, the court, like the legitimacy of the court is waning. Like these conservative justices have ruined the reputation of the court, right? And that's their lament. And that's a crazy lament because that doesn't actually make sense as a Democratic politician, which is what they are. And right, it's like whether or not the court is seen as legitimate, what it's going to do is overturn every act of democratic governance that it can get its hands on. That's what it's been doing. That's what it's going to do. That's the reality we live in. And so if you have a group like that that is totally beyond the scope of its charter, that is widely unpopular and is going to oppose everything you purport to care about, then you would say that this is the perfect time to pick a fight with the court. This is the perfect time to say there has to be reform. This is totally ridiculous. It's gone way too far. And we need to expand the court. We need to set term limits. We have to do some of these procedural reforms that without which there actually isn't going to be a democratic governance at all. And that's both small and capital D democratic governance. It's you know, that's the scope of the reality. It's so politically advantageous to Democrats to pick this fight right now. And they have to pick it because they can't do student debt cancellation. They can't do anything. And it's weird to be like, oh, this is, you know, it's so sad. The reputation is diminished. And like, we need to get John Roberts in here so he can really buff up the reputation and like, you know, assure us everything's fine. We can get people back on track loving the Supreme Court. It's like that doesn't actually help them at all. That's the opposite of what they should want. And so I actually do think it's a really good question is like, you know, we always talk about Biden, the institutionalists. Are Democrats going to be willing to pick this fight? Because it seems like basically any policy debate we might have from here on out is moot until that's dealt with. I mean, that's the sort of really, you know, bare bones political reality that we're in is like, we can't talk about like Medicare for all or like anything until you have judicial reform and the time. It's never been a better time to do it. And it's worked in the past, right? We can look back to Roosevelt picking a fight with the courts in the New Deal era. We have all this love for Roosevelt in the White House right now, but you just have to do it. And I don't know. I will see. I think it's genuinely up in the air. I don't think it's for sure that they will shy away from it. And it's crazy because forever I would have thought that's the case. I don't think it's for sure that they're going to pick this fight, but I think that it's something that's being talked about, which is really interesting.
Yeah, no, it is being talked about. Yeah. And actually, to your Roosevelt example, the earlier example is also Abraham Lincoln and the sort of, you know, Republicans and abolitionists in the Civil War era, because the courts were the great enemy, you know, like not just of sort of like abolitionism, but like, you know, in Dred Scott, like the very idea of African-Americans being citizens. And Lincoln very much did say, you know, like that if the courts can make these decisions, that means we don't have self-governance. And that is the kind of existential crisis you have when the courts, you know, take on this kind of role. And it's like the crisis, that, as you say, like there's a whole host of issues on which the Democrats' agenda can't move forward. I would add also environmentalism and sort of like any sort of regulations, because it looks like they might, you know, roll back some of the sort of, you know, Chevron deference that has existed since the 80s.
The whole administrative state, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at the more radical Clarence Thomas end of things, I mean, the end goal is a kind of dismantling of the administrative state. It's sort of based on this theory that the American Constitution has been in exile, you know, not just since the New Deal, but since Woodrow Wilson, and that one has to return, to the glory days of the robber barons, which in some ways, Harlan Crowe's relationship with Clarence Thomas is exactly like the progressive era where you did have billionaires that just owned public servants outright. That is the goal. Once he's like politically, there are more and more sort of democratic activists and some people in the Congress, like AOC, and even some in the Senate, like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, that are edging towards this position. Whether it becomes the mainstream Democratic position that then Biden takes up, I think that is an open question, and I think that's a very important question.
Right. And the other question is it's a matter of time, right? It's like That's the other issue. Is it does feel like these things are inching along. And then the big X factor is urgency. And if you look at if you look at the Senate map in 2024, it's almost hard to think, like, the fact that someone like Dick Durbin could feel no sense of urgency looking at that Senate map is shocking to me, because it's not like they've got years to figure this out. They have months to figure this out. Like, it's the window. This is very, very small. And so, will they figure it out? Maybe. Will they figure it out too late? That's another question. It does feel like something is happening, but is it enough? And is it quick enough? I don't know. Well, I guess that's where the intrigue lies.
That's right. That's right. I think that's a good question to kind of like end it on. I mean, that is, I think, where things stand. So once again, thanks to Alex Salmon from Slate. You can read his writing there. He writes about national politics in general. Very much worth reading. And once again, it's great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.